Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, we'll visit Camden and the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations for a talk by Donald P. Gregg, former U.S. Ambassador to Korea and Chairman of the Board of the Korea Society in New York City. His talk is entitled, Where Do We Go From Here on the Korean Peninsula? If you enjoy this program and would like to hear it again, it'll be archived on our website, mpbn.net. A service made possible by member support. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find a listing of available programs, including this, and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. Introducing the speaker is Mac DeFord, President of the Midcoast Forum.
For those who are listening to a Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations presentation for the first time, let me introduce ourselves. My name is Mac DeFord, and I'm the head of the forum, which was founded in 1983. We just celebrated our 25th anniversary by a small group living in the Midcoast area with an interest in the U.S. role in international relations. Membership is currently about 150 and includes former diplomats, international businessmen, retired academics, and others with an interest in foreign affairs. For further information, please see our website, www.midcoastforum.org. We have a monthly luncheon meeting, usually the second Monday, at the Samoset Resort in Rockport to hear an informed speaker discuss a topic of international interest. Today's speaker is Ambassador Donald Gregg, who's had a long and distinguished government career. He started with the CIA in the early 1950s, where he served in Japan, Burma, Vietnam, and Korea. In 1982, he retired from the agency at the request of then-Vice President George Bush to become his national security advisor. He was subsequently appointed by President Bush as our ambassador to Korea, where he served from 1989 to 1993. Following his retirement from government service, he became the head of the Korea Society in New York for about 15 years. He is currently the chairman emeritus. His talk today will be on Where Do We Go From Here on the Korean Peninsula? So let's give a warm welcome to Ambassador Gregg.
Thank you very much, Mac. Meg and I are delighted to be here in a state that I wish I saw more of. My mother's side of the family have deep roots in Maine. Captain John Finney, who was in King Philip's War, got a land grant in Gorham and was the first settler of Gorham. And we're going to pay our respects to him on the way home. Our son was born very prematurely, and the doctors held out no hope for his continuance, and so we had him baptized John Finney Gregg because there were eight John Finneys in a row on my mother's side, and I felt that the atavistic pull of that would have something to do with his survival, which it did. So anyway, I feel very strongly about Maine, and just am delighted to be here. I want to set the stage a little bit in terms of the Korean Peninsula, because we have a tendency as a people, I think, to believe that history begins when we get involved. And that as far as most Americans are concerned, Korean history began on the 25th of June, 1950, where we saved Korea, and everything else before that is irrelevant. That may be true for us, but it is not true for the Koreans. The first contact that the Koreans had with the United States came where a new U.S. naval vessel, not Navy, but a merchant ship named the Sherman, taking advantage of very high tides, got right into the middle of Pyongyang on the Taedong River. None of the crew survived, so we don't know exactly what they did, but according to the North Koreans, it was grave robbing and abuse of women. And the crew was not all American, I hasten to add. The Koreans attacked the ship and were driven off by its guns, And they then use fire rafts when the ship trying to leave got stuck on a sandbar and the ship was burned to the gunwales and all the crew was killed. And there's a statue commemorating that victory on the banks of the Taedong right next to the USS Pueblo, which the North Koreans seized in 1968. So as far as the North Koreans are concerned, they're ahead of us 2-0 in terms of naval warfare. In 1871, to retaliate for what had happened to the Sherman, we shot our way into Korea, going up the Han River, and killing about 400 Koreans defending mud forts at the entrance of the Han. We forced the Koreans to sign a treaty with us in 1883, and missionaries immediately followed who had a tremendous impact in Korea. Korea is now 35% to 40% Christian, as opposed to Japan, which is still less than 1% Christian. All went well until the Russo-Japanese War, which Teddy Roosevelt won a Nobel Peace Prize medal for settling at the Treaty of Portsmouth. And a secret codicil to that treaty was the Taft-Katsura Pact, which said to the Japanese, who were hankering to annex Korea, do anything you want in Korea, but don't mess with us in the Philippines. We were in our brief but rather virulent colonial period. And so the Japanese took full advantage of that and annexed Korea in 1910. They did everything they could to try to obliterate a Korean civilization that went back 5,000 years. The names of the cities were changed. The speaking of Korean was discouraged. All the Koreans were given Japanese names. And the Japanese did what they could to obliterate this very rich culture, and they did it with gross savagery from time to time. The Koreans, every Korean schoolchild knows about the Taft-Katsura Pact. I would say not one in a million Americans know about it, but it had a tremendous influence on shaping Korean views toward the United States. We did intervene in 1950 when the North Koreans came crashing down with the aid of particularly of the Soviet Union. Kim Il-sung had wanted to get Soviet support for the invasion in 1949, but Hitler and Mao decided that was a little premature because the Chinese had not yet completely controlled China, but in 1950, their takeover had been completed, and so both the Soviets and the Chinese supported the invasion. The Chinese intervened when MacArthur blundered up to the Yalu River, ignoring all kinds of signs that the Chinese were coming in. David Halberstam's book, The Coldest Winter, I recommend for you if you want to get Mac MacArthur in a very clear and unflattering context. By 1951, after the Chinese had intervened and MacArthur had been replaced by Ridgway, the Chinese were being slaughtered and asked Stalin if they could call the war off with a truce, and his answer was niet. He said, it's very good for you Chinese to learn to fight a modern army. We learned it against the Nazis, and you're learning it against the Americans, and it makes the Americans easier to deal with in Europe because we're bleeding them in Asia. And it was not until Stalin's death in March of 1953 that it was possible to have an armistice that brought the war to an end. I first ran into Koreans in 1952 when I trained Korean commandos for poorly designed operations behind enemy lines where most of them died. But I was tremendously impressed by their courage, by their humor, and by just the vital nature of their characters. I then spent 10 years in Japan. I used to speak pretty good Japanese, and it was interesting to observe the degradation with which the Japanese treated Koreans in general and the Koreans whom they had forced to come to Japan as forced labor in particular. Everything was blamed on the Koreans, including the great earthquake of 1923. It sounds funny, but it wasn't. 6,000 Koreans were murdered because they were blamed for somehow causing it. So I first set foot in Korea in 1968 and was just absolutely swept away by the directness of the Koreans. I could speak Japanese. They'd all been forced to speak Japanese, so I could move very freely around the country. And the only assignment I ever requested was to go to Korea, where I went as chief of station from 1973 to 1975. And it was there that I first encountered Cheryl Lichty, a doctor here practicing in this neighborhood, who was born about that time. Isn't that about correct?
Just about.
Just about. Great to have you here. My tour in Seoul was a colorful one because Park Chung-hee was the president of Korea, and he had sent a lot of troops to help us in Vietnam. Now, let's have a little quiz. How many troops do you think the Koreans sent to help us in Vietnam?
10,000.
60,000. Anything else? 312,000. Four divisions there, full-time for 5 years. And so in 1973, Park Chung-hee saw us getting booted out of Vietnam, and he was a very tough, practical man, and he began to worry about our reliability as an ally. When the Korean Peninsula was divided by the United States, another thing they hold against us, a 10-minute decision made by Dean Rusk and an Army colonel using a National Geographic map, because we made no provision for dealing with the Soviets, whom we had urged to attack Japan. They had waited until after we dropped our first nuclear weapon to attack Japan and then swept through Manchuria and were headed right down the Korean Peninsula trying to dominate it with their eye on Japan. And so the best idea we had was to draw a line at the 38th parallel, give the Soviets sway in the north, and we had it in the south. So that sort of set the stage. And at the time of the division, the northern part of Korea was infinitely more powerful and well-endowed than the southern half. It's rather like the Italian peninsula. When I went there in 1973, the North Koreans were found to be digging tunnels under the demilitarized zone. There were air raid alarms. There was a curfew at midnight. And I was there serving with an American general with whom I'd served in Vietnam. And he told me that if there was a full-throated North Korean attack at that time, we couldn't possibly hold Seoul. So it was a very difficult situation in 73. Park Chung-hee had lost faith in us as an ally, and so he started a nuclear weapons program, which we discovered and stopped. He also bought weapons systems, which we did not want the North Koreans to have for fear of their using them in a provocative way against the North. And so there were interesting reporting to do on that. And during that same time, Kim Dae-jung, who had run against Park Chung-hee in a presidential election in 1971, was kidnapped from his hotel room in Japan, where he'd been making critical comments about Park Chung-hee's rather iron-fisted rule. And so those were a few of the highlights of my tour as chief of station from 73 to 75. We managed to keep Kim Dae-jung alive. He went on to eventually become president of South Korea. He held a summit with North Korea and won the Nobel Peace Prize. I attended his funeral last month, and it was a very moving affair for me to be part of, because a number of Americans had worked effectively to keep him alive. Both liberal President Carter and conservative President Reagan had really devoted a lot of effort to making sure that he survived, and it was a very, very fine effort, as I think Kim Dae-jung was one of the greatest Asians that I have met. During my tour as ambassador, which began in 1989, we became concerned about North Korea's nuclear program. And we had nuclear weapons in South Korea. And so, knowing the practical-minded Koreans, I began to feel that if we are going to press the North Koreans not to build nuclear weapons, the first thing they would say is, well, why should we do that when you've got them in South Korea? And I also knew that the United States never moves a weapons system out under pressure. And so I began to talk to the commander, the four-star general in Seoul, and later the Korean president, suggesting that we ought to get our nuclear weapons out of South Korea in order to be able to push harder on the North Koreans to do the same. It was a very interesting case of inertia. I asked the four-star general, I said, why do we have nuclear weapons in South Korea? Do you plan to use them if we're attacked? He said, absolutely not. I said, why are they here? Well, they've always been here. So after about a year, I was able to send a message back to Washington saying, with the full support of the President of Korea and General Raskasi, the commander of U.S. forces, we recommend that nuclear weapons be removed. And George Herbert Walker Bush used that as, I think, the keystone for removing all of our tactical nuclear weapons from being land-based around the world, which I think was a constructive state of move to take. The Koreans at that point, the South Koreans, decided to emulate Willy Brandt's Ostpolitik in trying to reach out to North Korea, and they called it Nordpolitik. When I arrived as ambassador, they had only one Eastern European country represented in Seoul. And with the help of President Bush, by the time I left, everyone was there, including the Russians and the Chinese. A good deal of progress was made between North and South Korea at that time. 8 prime ministerial visits were exchanged. And the key to it was the cancellation of a massive training exercise called Team Spirit, which was held annually, and it involved the sending to Korea of 10,000 or more troops, a training exercise as indicating what we would do if the North Koreans invaded the South again. And it drove the North Koreans up the wall. They always went on full alert when that was undertaken. And so we got it canceled, and that really paved the way for the progress to be made between North and South Korea. In the fall of 1992, without my being consulted, the Team Spirit was reinstated. The worst decision made during my time as ambassador, and I investigated as to why it had been done, and the key person was Dick Cheney, who was Secretary of Defense. And Cheney was not particularly interested in the kind of progress that was being made, as he came from the regime change school of thought, which is still, I think, alive and well in our country. The cancellation or the reinstatement of Team Spirit caused the North Koreans to think we hadn't been serious. They withdrew from the NPT. And a major crisis ensued in 1994, which caused Jimmy Carter to come to North Korea, where he visited with Kim Il-sung and talked directly to him. And the project or the crisis was alleviated. And things moved forward jerkily. In the United States, Don Rumsfeld was writing a report on missile threats to the United States. And conveniently for him, the North Koreans fired a multi-stage Taepodong missile, which crashed into the sea, but it flew over Japan, rattled the Japanese cage, and the North Koreans became the poster child for missile defense. So we have Rumsfeld and Cheney deeply involved in formulating the attitude toward the North Koreans. Toward the end of his term, Bill Clinton sent Bill Perry to North Korea to deal with the missile issue. Bill Perry had been Secretary of Defense, a very admirable man, and he brought a solution to it. And as a result, the North Koreans sent their second highest ranking man to visit Washington in October of 2000. And Bill Clinton was still in office. Marshal Joe Myung-rok went to the White House in North Korean uniform and invited Bill Clinton to go to Pyongyang. And Clinton sent Madeleine Albright, his Secretary of State, to check that out. Al Gore gave a lunch for Joe Myung-rok at the top floor of the State Department, which was very moving to me because things were said by the North Koreans and by us indicating that we really had a vision for establishing normal relations and getting rid of the Cold War division, which still haunted the Korean Peninsula. Time ran out. Clinton didn't go. George W. Bush took office, and the first thing that was said about Korea was by Colin Powell, who said, "We're going to take up where Clinton left off." And he now says, "I was a little too far forward on my skis," and he was pulled back. And in George W. Bush instigated a policy review on North Korea, and in his State of the Union address in January 2002, he called North Korea part of the axis of evil, along with Iran and Iraq. And the North Koreans had done nothing in the intervening year to really justify that being hung on them. Kim Dae-jung had been elected president in 1997, and he invited me to his inauguration and urged me to plant the Korea Society flag in North Korea. He said, "You run the Korea Society, but you're not doing anything with North Korea, and you should be doing things with the entire peninsula, so please do what you can to become involved with the North Koreans." I was glad to do that. And in April 2002, I paid my first visit to North Korea. And that came about by my writing a letter to Kim Jong-il saying, "Dear Chairman Kim, we have been attacked by people who would love to get their hands on nuclear weapons. You are heading in that direction, and we need to talk about that so that we are never in the position of having to deal with a country which gives nuclear weapons to people who would have no compunctions about using them against us." I took this to North Korean ambassador to the UN, whom I knew, and I got a very typical Korean reaction from him. He read it, and then he glared at me, and he said, "How dare you write a letter like that to my chairman? Who do you think you are?" And I said, "Well, I'm just telling your chairman some things that I think he ought to know, and I think I know how his mind works." And he said, "How can you possibly know how his mind works?" And I said, "Well, I've talked to a Russian who sat with him on a train when he was going to Moscow to visit Putin. I talked to Madeleine Albright, who had 11 hours of discussion with him. I talked with Chinese, who heard him in a Buick plant in China saying to his aides, 'This is the kind of thing we need to do in North Korea.' And I've talked to Kim Dae-jung, who had a summit meeting with him." And he said, "Well, that's a good answer. I'll send your letter." So I was invited almost immediately to go. I had not told anyone that I wrote this letter. And as soon as I got the invitation, I alerted the State Department. They were very happy about it. And they assigned a Korean-speaking Foreign Service officer to come with me. I then had a fascinating meeting with Kim Gae-gwan, who was my usual contact. He is their lead nuclear negotiator. And I'm going to dwell on this a little bit because it's, I think, so indicative of their mindset. Three questions he asked me. First, why is George W. Bush so different from his father? Now, how do you answer that? I said, well, his father was raised in New England and his son was raised in Texas. His second question was, how do you function as a country when you elect people as your president who have nothing to do with their predecessor? And how do you establish continuity when you do that? And I said, well, that's a good question. You have what we might call euphemistically continuity of leadership. But in a democracy, that's the way things work. And the people change their mind, and they decide that they want to go a different direction, and that often results in a president that thinks very differently from his predecessor. And he said, well, that makes you a very difficult country to deal with. And so then he said, why don't you understand us better? And I said, because I consider North Korea the longest-running failure in the history of American espionage. And I can say I'm qualified to say that because I'd been involved, I'd been chasing the North Koreans around Asia ever since the 1950s. And I said we could recruit Soviets, we could recruit Chinese, but we really couldn't recruit you guys. And I could sort of see them swelling with pride as I said this. And so I went on at some length, and he then absolutely astonished me by saying, do you have your op center hat on as you say this? And I said, what? He said, you heard me. And I said, you're not referring to a paperback book by Tom Clancy, are you? He said, of course I am. And op center, for those of you wise enough not to have read it, had a co-author named Steve Pachenik who knew me. And so the lead character in Op Center is named Gregory Donald. And he also served as station chief in Korea and then ambassador. So there's a certain resemblance. And I had a number of hilarious phone calls when the book came out. And so I said, well, I haven't read it, but my wife has, and would you like her reaction? And he said, yes, we would. And I said, well, she refers to it as an airport-only paperback. And I said she didn't mind the fact that I had died a heroic death at the end of the book, but she was furious about the fact that I'd had a Korean mistress. So I tell you that because these guys are Koreans. We, you know, we have two tendencies in our foreign policy. One is to think about regime change where we're dealing with a country that doesn't do what we think they ought to do. And that reached its height when the Dulles brothers were in power, John Foster at State and Alan Welsh at CIA. And they produced a list of eight countries where we were going to bring about regime change, and number one was Iran. And that was viewed as a great success at the time. Number two was Guatemala, which put in power a bloody-minded man that led to just decades of horror in Guatemala. And third was Cuba, which was a failure, and I think at that point they tore up their list. But the tendency toward that lingers. We also have another tendency, and that is to demonize leaders that we don't like nor understand. We did it with Ho Chi Minh, and we do it with Kim Jong-il. They're both sort of odd-looking foreigners, and it's very easy to do it visually. The problem with demonization is that when you do it, you fill your gaps of ignorance with prejudice, and it makes you very, very difficult to have any kind of sense of the vicarious. I was invited to a conference in England several years ago, pulled together by a set of highly qualified spooks to see how we had missed the call in Iraq. And I happened to meet there the third man to be knighted by MI6. One would have thought there'd been more than that, but there was one after World War I, one after World War II, and this man who was knighted in 2004. And so I, of course, asked what he'd done to justify this, and was told that he had talked Gaddafi into giving up his nuclear weapons. And so I immediately sat down with him and said, how did this happen? And he said, well, when I first was given this job, he was fluent in Arabic. He said, I thought Gaddafi was an absolute nutcase. And I would go out into the desert and meet him in his tent, and he would keep me waiting, and then he would just come swanning in, fully as though he'd just gotten off a camel. And we would have these bizarre conversations. But as they went on, something else began to emerge, and that was an understanding on my part of why he was behaving as he was, and a sense on his part as to why we were so concerned about his development of nuclear weapons. The Americans were brought in, and the man who was brought in is now deputy director of CIA. He's a very good officer, and that's how it happened. I raised this with my friend Kim Gae-gwan in Pyongyang on one of my visits, and he said, stop dreaming about Libya. That was his exact remark. He said, that happened after months of deep dialogue. I haven't had 1 hour of dialogue with the Bush administration. And there you have it. So the dialogue with North Korea has had ebbs and flows. The first 6 years of the Bush administration were basically wasted. Toward the end, once he got rid of Rumsfeld and Condi Rice went to be Secretary of State, they thought better of it. And Chris Hill, who was a graduate of Bowdoin, a wonderful guy, became ambassador to the United States, to Korea, and then later assistant secretary, and he pushed dialogue very hard, but again, time ran out on him. The Japanese have not been at all helpful. They are obsessed by the handful of Japanese abducted by the North, and they have not really supported us very strongly on this issue. The Chinese have been extremely helpful. And they were really the mainstay of the six-party talks, which we are now insisting be resumed. There has been, I think I'm about at the time where I should stop, Obama had a number of other issues which were of far greater import to him, such as the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, health care, the economy, and so he did not pay an awful lot of attention to North Korea. The North Koreans didn't like this, and so they have fired off missiles and had a second nuclear test to try to get his attention. There are some who say they will never give up nuclear weapons. I don't believe that. I think they have quite a realistic view of where they are, and what they are, and what their limits are. And they also find themselves more completely isolated than ever before as a result of sanctions and a result of strong diplomacy on the part of the United States. So I think we are sort of edging our way forward toward a resumption of of talks with the North Koreans. And I think if these talks are sustained and sophisticated, I think they still can be talked into giving up their nuclear weapons. That's what they say to people who talk to them privately, but there are a lot of bellicose statements which they make publicly, which sort of cloud the issue. But it's the Korean Peninsula should not have been divided. It's tragic that it's still divided. But having been there five times, I think we need to solve it. My last trip there was with the New York Philharmonic. I went across the DMZ with Bill Perry to get there. That was moving in itself. The reception that the North Koreans gave to the Philharmonic was extraordinary. The individual lessons given by the master musicians to young North Koreans were very moving to observe, and the North Koreans are desperate to send their state symphony orchestra to the United States, and we're trying to help arrange that. So I think there are ways to move forward. I wrote a letter to Vice President Biden before the two young American journalists were released, urging that somebody very high-ranking be sent to deal with that issue. The North Koreans are very hierarchical, and they've said to me, you're okay, but you're not high enough to really solve our problems. And so they want cabinet rank or vice president or presidential clout. And they got it with Bill Clinton, and I hope that more of that will follow. I suggested to Biden that the interlocutor carry a letter from Obama which invited the designated son, Kim Jong-un, who's 26 years old, to come to the United States for a guided tour of the United States set up by the White House. And I don't think they would accept it, but I think the offering of it would be the kind of respectful gesture which resonates deeply in a society like that. So I suggested the first time I went there that they return the Pueblo, and they were prepared to do it. They repaired it. It was ready to sail out to sea until they were called part of the Axis of Evil by Bush. So you can get to them. And I think if the Brits got to Gaddafi, if we put our minds to it, we can get to the North Koreans. And I think sooner or later, Obama will find a way to do that. Thank you very much.
Don, that was fascinating. That was absolutely great. Now we've got time for, since we started late, we've got time for questions. Because we've got a new system in place, I don't have to repeat the question. So just make sure that you speak loud. Jim.
Thank you very much for that marvelous overview. But in terms of prospects, how stable is the current regime? What are the prospects for succession? And will there be a potential explosion of contention or a kind of smooth transition from insiders?
I don't know the answer to that question, but there are a few straws in the wind. Bill Clinton, who's an extraordinarily observant man, brought back some very good humint on the state of play in North Korea. And he found Kim Jong-il to be in seemingly very good health. The fact that he's lost some weight is probably good for him. And his son apparently has now been more or less accepted as the heir designate. And so I'm of the school of thought. There are still those who say, let's get rid of Kim Jong-il and let's have a regime change. The Chinese fear that more than anything. I think what we hope for is 3 or 4 years where Kim Jong-il retains control, which he has now, clearly, and Kim Jong-un can emerge as a plausible succession figure. If that doesn't happen, then it's Katie bar the door, because we really have no idea who would try to leap into the breach.
Really. You mentioned two things. The original division of Korea being no good, And you mentioned, you used the words ebbs and flows. Do you think there is the remotest possibility, leaving U.S. politics, China, all that out, that the people of North and South will ever be able to be joined again in a single nation?
I think that is inevitable. Absolutely inevitable. The question is, how long will it take? And I think both sides of the peninsula are not interested in anything happening quickly. If it happened quickly, the South Koreans couldn't afford it. They have looked at the costs involved in the German reunification, and the disparity between North and South Korean economies is far greater than that which obtained between East and West Germany. If it happened quickly, it would mean that North Korea had flown apart and would have become very unstable and chaotic. But the Korean-ness still obtains. They have a 5,000-year history, and they have been divided really since 1950. And so my feeling is it's going to happen. I hope it takes 15 to 20 to 30 years, and I think it's sure to happen by that time.
Would you expand on your statement that China is against getting rid of the current regime?
China fears any kind of political implosion in Korea. They are already stressed out by the number of North Koreans who are coming across the border, which is undefended. The demilitarized zone is still very heavily defended, strewn with mines. It's a good obstruction to the outflows of refugees which would follow a collapse of leadership. They would all head north. And the Chinese do not want to deal with that. And those who know the Chinese far better than I say they really would prefer to deal with a nuclear-armed North Korea than a Korea that has imploded. We're not happy with that. They don't want nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula because of the immediate impact on Japan. But they feel they would have longer to deal with that issue than they would have if there was an implosion which triggered a massive inflow of refugees from Korea. Yeah. Good questions, all.
You mentioned Kim Jong-il's trip to Moscow to see Putin and company. Do you see Putin, Medvedev, or any of the other Russian leaders playing any sort of a positive role in the six power talks or in any other way with regard to Korean problems?
Well, the Russians, is it possible for the Russians to play a constructive role in the six-party process? The big objective that Russia has very clearly, which they state all the time, is that a united Korean peninsula would make it infinitely easier for them to exploit and export their the massive natural resources which they have in eastern Russia. And that is their main objective. They're talking about gas pipelines, the reconstruction of the railroad, and that is a very big plus. And so they are doing all they can to be helpful, to bring about gradual reconciliation, which will enable that kind of thing to happen. So they're not playing dog in the manger. They don't have any subversive aims. The most disruptive and unhelpful member of the six-party process is by far is Japan. And that's an interesting story because Koizumi went to Japan to talk about the Japanese who had been kidnapped by Kim Il-sung so that they could learn from them how to train North Koreans to act like Japanese and be sent as spies to Japan. And there were 18 meetings held between the North Koreans and the Japanese to lay out what the North Koreans would admit to. And so Koizumi knew what he was getting, which was Kim Jong-il saying, This should not have happened. I regret it. It will not be repeated. Now, I've said to my Chinese friends, I've never heard you say anything like that about Mao Zedong. And they said, well, we say it behind our hands. That was a tremendous admission by Kim Jong-il. And instead of taking it and running, they say, well, where are the other six? And they knew, and the press took it and just absolutely destroyed any possibility of that. In my last meeting with the North Koreans, with Bill Perry, I said, you guys have got to level with us on what you were doing in Syria and what you got from AQ Khan. And I said, we are not going to do to you what the Japanese did to you, and that is take your admission as something to use against you. I said that, but I don't think they believe it. I mean, it was the biggest concession that North Korea ever made, and the Japanese just crapped on it. Pardon me.
North Korea has been isolated pretty much from the powers in the world, but they must have a need for resources of various kinds outside their country. Who do they deal with?
Essentially China, for oil in particular. They also need help from everybody in terms of food. They are never going to be able to feed themselves. It's an arid country. Their agriculture is very primitive. And the outside world has been generous to them in terms of food. Yes. One of the things they're very interested in is better information contacts with the world. So the Korea Society has been working with Syracuse University and Kimchek University in Pyongyang for about 10 years on an IT exchange. Syracuse came to me more than 10 years ago and said, we took IT into the Soviet Union and China, and we think that helped open them up to the world. Do you think we could possibly do it with North Korea? And the answer has been yes. They are very much interested in stronger understanding of the outside world and stronger connections to the outside world. But they can't feed themselves. They don't have enough energy. Their coal is lousy. They are very interested in atomic power. But until we get them to sign, seal, and deliver that they're not interested in nuclear weapons, we're not going to let them go that way. So it's complicated. But they need outside help, and they have been getting it primarily from China, a lot from South Korea, and a lot from the United States in terms of food aid.
They can't feed themselves because of the aridity of the country. What are their natural resources or their other resources? And could you remind us of the population of North Korea?
It's about 20 million. It's less than a little less than half of South Korea. They have minerals. They have gold. They have sand, industrial sand. They have iron ore. They have a lot of very rare metal ores, which have not been explored. On one of my trips to North Korea, I met a couple of gold miners, one from Malaysia, one from Australia, and he said this place, with proper mining equipment, there's millions and millions of dollars to be made here. So it's sort of like the Italian peninsula in terms of mineral resources. They also have water power, and you had an example of that when they released some water from a dam without telling the South Koreans.
A fascinating presentation. I was taken by your point that the Japanese were the least helpful nation in the multi-party talks. Could you explain some of the factors that influence Japanese attitudes towards North Korea and South Korea, whether they're diplomatic, economic, or cultural?
There's a phrase in Japanese, shimaguni konjo, the prejudice of island people. The Brits have it, and the Japanese have it. They look down on their neighbors on the continent, and particularly the Koreans. They don't want to admit that a lot of their religion came from Korea. They don't like want to admit that their pot-making culture came from Korea. It's very difficult to change these prejudices. I think they are basically cultural. I'm hoping that this new political leadership will be a little more enlightened. The emperor astonished the Japanese about 10 years ago, saying, "I look forward to going to Korea because that's where our ancestors came from." That went over, that sank like a lead balloon in Japan, because that's not what the Japanese, it's true, but that's not what the Japanese want to hear. So they are really very unconstructed. They have never really faced up to what they did to their neighbors in World War II, unlike the Germans. So they have never really rendered a verdict on their own conduct in World War II and before World War II the way the Germans have about what the Nazis did.
Don, on that note, I want to thank you very much. And
you've been listening to Donald P. Gregg, former U.S. Ambassador to Korea, on Speaking in Maine. If you missed part of this Speaking in Maine program or enjoyed it and would like to hear it again, you can do so by visiting mpbn.net and clicking Audio On Demand under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen. There you'll find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellis.